a Fueled by Coffee production.
Hello, my name is Ben Burrell, and this is Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording, record by record. I hope all is good and you're enjoying the season so far. We have a little announcement to start the show. Congratulations to the winner of our competition, who is Brett Cole. Brett, congratulations. You have won a Bob Dylan Album by Album turntable slip mat and also the brilliant book, Why Dylan Matters. If you did get involved with our competition and you bought me a coffee, then thank you. There were so many entries. It's really heartwarming to see. We might do another little competition before the end of the season, actually, because that one went so well. So stick around for that. In the meantime, this episode marks a little, I guess, mini season within this main season. From now until the end of this season, we are looking at Bob's Christian period. He released three albums with overt Christian themes in them, and we're going to have a look at them, and also in a couple of special episodes, the context around those albums too. Let's start with this, the first album of his Christian period. This is 1979's Slow Train Coming. On the 17th of March 1978, Bob Dylan was on stage in San Francisco, California. "Towards the end of the show, someone out in the crowd knew I wasn't feeling too well," he recalls. "I think they could see that, and they threw a silver cross onto the stage. Now, usually I don't pick things up on the stage, but I looked down at that cross and I said, I've got to pick that up. So I did, and I put it in my pocket." Things would never quite be the same. Dylan was born again. Of course, it's not quite as simple as that, but we've come to a point in Bob's career where he turned to Christianity and released three LPs with discussions of Christ and his religion. Despite the consensus amongst casual observers, the music in this period is actually pretty good. I still remember my dad sitting me down and telling me not to write off these records when I was first getting into Dylan. But it is an era that has the potential to be a little bit patchy at times. This record comes off the back of the Blood on the Tracks, Basement Tapes, Desire, Street Legal run, which was a second purple patch for Dylan. While Street Legal was received less well than others, it's still a good collection of songs. However, by 1978, Dylan was regressing back to the place he was before he rose from the dead with Blood on the Tracks. There was a lukewarm reaction to a lot of his live shows, and in that year he also released a four-hour film he'd written and directed, which was largely received negatively. This album would reverse that decline somewhat. It's a good starting point for a time that would test Dylan and his fans. We're eased into this new direction with some good songs, some strong album sales, and even a hit single. We'd been easing away from Bob's signature sound with Desire and Street Legal, but they still retained core Dylan touch points. However, here on this track, he swerved into a whole new lane. You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You might like to dance. It's easy to see why this song became a hit. Its melody is catchy. It's basically a pop tune through and through. Bob's lyrics aren't the best, but they too are poppy and very satisfying for a listener. Whilst obviously the song is rooted in Christianity, it's not particularly preachy or intense. Bob eases us into this newfound religion with a bit of light relief before hitting us with the harder stuff later. He even chucks in a bit of frivolity. He does it concerning his name at one point, referencing the comedian Ray J. Johnson. As a song, I quite like it. Its production has a much more contemporary sound compared to the dusty Street Legal sonics. There's one thing about this era that it did do for Bob, and that was it brought him kicking and screaming into a modern age. The keyboards here are from Barry Beckett, who also acts as the LP's secondary producer. He dominates the tune, and despite their potential, they don't sound out of date listening back now. The guitar work here and on the rest of the LP comes from Dire Straits frontman Mark Knopfler. Dylan first met Knopfler when his assistant and engineer Arthur Asato played him the Dire Straits single Sultans of Swing. Later on March the 29th, 1979, Dylan caught the final show of a Dire Straits residency at the Roxy in Los Angeles, California. Bob approached Mark after the show and asked him to take part in his next record. He does a good job on the LP and ends up being one of the record's signature sounds, as is the backing vocals that were present on the previous album that have been brought to this one. Here they come from Regina Havis and Carolyn Dennis, who would of course end up marrying Bob in the next decade. Not both of them, Carolyn only. Both these performances give the song a quality and sturdiness, just like we saw on the Billy the Kid soundtrack, or if we're being honest, pretty much any of Bob's studio albums. Bob is surrounding himself with the best, making sure that every tune is given the chance to be the best it can possibly be with these musicians. Despite this, the song did have its detractors. Famously, John Lennon didn't like it at all. On hearing Bob's new direction, he would say shortly before his death, "It's the same man, but it isn't the same man." He would record Serve Yourself, a parody of Bob's song, and in it, he is furious. He sings, "You say you found Jesus, Christ.
You got to save yourself, nobody's gonna do for you. You gotta save yourself, nobody gonna do for you. Well, you may believe in devils and you may be loving laws, but you're not gonna have to save yourself, lad.
Ain't no room service here. Think you'd have fallen, man."
In juxtaposition to the Lennon song, the Dylan cut is, for the most part, concerning reporting to a higher power. Bob's declaring that God exists, but so does the devil. You might be someone important like an ambassador or heavyweight champion of the world, but you're reporting back to the devil or to God. You decide. He sings, "You're going to have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody." While the religious overtones and the sonics of this song can be a turn-off for some, I like it. It was, however, ranked in the top 10 worst Dylan songs of all time in a Rolling Stone poll in 2013. Another song from this album also makes that top 10. It's the LP's penultimate tune, "Man Gave Names to All the Animals." Here Bob combines religious lyrics with reggae rock. On paper, that doesn't sound the best, and in practice, it isn't the best either. I'm not a fan of reggae when it's that reggae by numbers instrumentation, and here we get that in abundance. That tippy-tappy snare drum and twinkling electric piano are just a little bit too much for me. Bob would do reggae much better with Sly and Robbie on the Infidels album 4 years later, but that feels a world away here. With the lyrics, we cruise round a Book of Genesis landscape trapped in a performance of a nursery rhyme.
"You saw an animal upon a hill, chewing up so much grass until he was filled. He saw milk coming out, but he didn't know how. I think I call it a cow."
The only thing that saves the song from being a complete write-off is its final lines. We hear Bob singing, "He saw an animal as smooth as glass, slithering his way through the grass. Saw him disappear by a tree near a lake.
He saw an animal as smooth as glass, slithering his way through the grass. He saw him disappear by a tree near a lake."
Which, like when we saw on another episode of this podcast when looking at All Along the Watchtower, has a brilliant, intriguing ending, leaving us with a sense of dread. It just seems to stop and we're left to fill in the rest as that snake slithers its way to cause havoc for Adam and Eve. Of course, the song is easy to defend, and many have, as a fun children's tune. But for me, it's just bad. However, for some, it does hold up. Rolling Stone described it as clever in an early review. In fact, the early reviews of this album were pretty good, something that has been slightly muddied since. In that same Rolling Stone review, Jan Winner declares, "In time, it is possible that it could even be considered his greatest," which hasn't aged particularly well. The Village Voice gave the album a B+, saying it was his best album since Blood on the Tracks, which again I disagree with. The songs on both Desire and Street Legal that came after Blood on the Tracks for me outperform the ones here. However, they did note that Dylan's singing is passionate and detailed, which I do agree with. There's a bit more vocal showcasing here on this record than on your average Dylan album. He's not moving through the scales doing vocal gymnastics or anything like that, but there are some decent performances. Take track 2, for example.
"Shine your light on me.
At a concert in Seattle on the 14th of January 1980, Dylan claimed this song is addressed to the woman who brought him to Christianity. He sings on the opening verse, "Precious angel under the sun, how was I to know you'd be the one? To show me I was blinded, to show me I was gone. How weak was the foundation I was standing upon." That final line is the attention grabber for me. As we already know, Dylan's life towards the end of the 60s was in danger of cracking up. All that followed, from the motorcycle crash to the breakdown of his marriage, points to a man looking for meaning. Here he basks in that and the woman who showed him the path, as in the chorus we hear, shine your light on me. You know I couldn't make it by myself, I'm a little too blind to see. The guitar licks in this song are once again classic Knopfler, whilst the brass comes from the Muscle Shoals horns. Speaking of that, the whole album was cut in the Muscle Shoals studio, a famous studio in Sheffield, Alabama. Dylan approached Jerry Wexler to produce the album. He said what he wanted was a tailored big funk sound, which he didn't have on his record. He wanted a little more precision, a little more musical input. It was something that he felt at the time. Wexler also goes on to say it was his, not Dylan's, idea to bring in Knopfler. Regardless, Wexler brings a seasoned producer to the record. He oversaw the ensemble recording, something he'd done many times with artists like Wilson Pickett and Aretha Franklin and Dusty Springfield. The first session for the album began on the 30th of April 1979. Dylan retained only two members from his 1978 touring band, the backing singers Helena Springs and the already mentioned Carolyn Dennis. The veteran bassist Tim Drummond was hired, as was the Dire Straits drummer Pick Withers, who appears on Knopfler's recommendation, unsurprisingly. And as we know, keyboardist Barry Beckett was employed, as were the Muscle Shoals horns. In fact, all the key elements of the celebrated Muscle Shoals sound were brought in. The first session wasn't to be too fruitful. Most of the day was dedicated to recording a song called Trouble in Mind, which actually ends up not making the final record. Wexler and Dylan also clashed. Bob wanted a more live sound, but the producer was trying to capture that with a little bit more cohesion. Dylan refused to wear headphones, adamant they didn't contribute to his studio sounds. It looks like he just wanted to cut the songs there and then. Bob began playing and singing along with the musicians, recalls Wexler. We were in the stages of building the rhythm arrangements, and it was too soon for him to sing, but he sang on every take anyway. I finally persuaded him to hold off on the vocals until later, when the arrangements were in shape and the players could place their licks around, not against Bob. Once arrangements were set, Dylan could focus on recording a strong vocal take, while subsequent overdubs would then fill in the gaps. Perhaps that's why, for the most part, his vocals on here sound great. Also, it would appear Bob can get easily bored in the studio. We've seen, especially on his self-produced albums, most things are cut live with little overdubs later. He likes to capture a track's mood. If there's little mistakes, he doesn't seem to care. But it can be hard to get the perfect take whilst doing that. The whole process seems to be a balancing act against getting a take that retains the spontaneity without too many mistakes. For some of the tracks on the LP to tread this line, they did the basic track, a master take that Dylan would then put his vocals to. Then later, the rest of the musicians would come in and fill in with some small amount of overdubs, recutting bits or adding a little detail to a largely completed song. On Precious Angel, for example, the bass, guitar, organ and horns would all be overdubbed a week after recording the master vocal take. As we've seen in many bootleg recordings, Dylan also likes to record the songs without really playing them to the other musicians in the sessions. They're encouraged to almost follow suit and get the idea as the tape is rolling. It's like everyone is whittling down a song from a lump of wood. However, here, once again, it was different. Bob might run it down on the piano or the guitar, just singing and playing in the background, until the session players had a rough shape in their minds. Then the Muscle Shoals band would come in and play on it, recalls Wexler. Unlike a fair amount of Bob's album sessions, the Slow Train Coming studio time would actually run pretty smoothly and be quite effective after that slow start. The basic tracks for the surrounding 10 songs in the sessions were recorded in just 6 3-hour runs over a period of 3 days. The first takes of I Believe in You and Gonna Change My Way of Thinking would become the basic tracks for the masters. The final song recorded was When He Returns. Its role as the album's closer was already decided, but Dylan planned on having Springs or Dennis sing the lead vocal. After doing a guide vocal with Beckett on the piano, he would then change his mind, which is a shame because that's an interesting concept. But all is not lost. The song itself is one of the best on here. As you might expect from a religious album, we have a gospel-type piano, a sound that Bob has flirted with before. Here, though, he manages to stay on the right side of preachy and deliver a sermon crooned over some nice piano chords.
The iron hand that ain't no match for the iron rod.
Yes, Beckett's playing is a little bit showy here, and it does verge on the show tunesy at times, but I've got to say, I'm a sucker for it. Bob's vocals are also incredible, and it's the best example of that earlier mentioned performance from him on the album. Dylan practiced all night before the day of record. The final take was selected as the master of the song, and for me, it's one of his best.
It is only he who can read.
The lyrics are unsurprisingly religious. When he returns, concerns the second coming of Jesus, as we hear a love letter about God. At times, it's almost a love letter to the Almighty. On the opening verse, Dylan says nothing can match God, not man's power, represented here by the iron hand, or man's creations, represented by a wall. He sings, "The iron hand, it ain't no match for the iron rod. The strongest wall will crumble and fall to a mighty God." The iron rod there is a reference to the book of Revelations. "And out of his mouth goeth a sharp sword, that with it shall smite the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron." This happens throughout the song. For example, at the end of the second verse, Dylan sings, "Truth is an arrow, and the gate is narrow that it passes through," which sounds like it comes from Matthew 7:14, "because the strait is the gate, and narrow is the way which leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it." He finishes by really ramming home his point. The final lines are, "Of every earthly plane that be known to man, he is unconcerned. He's got plans of his own to set up his throne when he returns." Despite how it looks on paper, the Dylan performance manages to be not too grating, possibly because there's a good song that is the stage for these words. In fact, it actually makes me, an unreligious man, intrigued by religion. It's a powerful song. There's another song that's always mentioned alongside this one when talking about Dylan's Christian run, and that's the album's title track. Although, on closer inspection, it's not really a religious song. It's sort of a protest song. We heard when Wexler was approached by Dylan, he wanted a big funk sound. Well, here, we get it.
Sometimes, feels a love down in disgust.
Listen to that guitar in the right ear. It's great. In fact, it's so good, this becomes one of the best produced songs of this entire era. I do feel at times in the 70s and the 80s, Bob threw in some backing vocals, brilliant though they are, just to plump up the sound a bit. But here, they actually end up becoming a highlight of the song. Knopfler's guitar work is predictably slick and polished, and the brass adds some snap to the song's sound. A little bit of pizzazz, you might say. But my favourite bit is the riff and the beat of it all. It is, as we know, a funk tune, but it's not Dylan doing funk in an embarrassing karaoke at a wedding style. It's Dylan's funk, and he actually nails it. The lyrics go into Bob's famous finger-pointing territory and for me have a similarity to the album that we get after this period, Infidels. That record had lots of lyrics criticising a number of things from technology to American foreign policy. Here, singing as a Christian convert, Dylan shuns the biblical references for the most part, although Satan is mentioned briefly, and needles at his friends, his country, injustice, greed, poverty, and pretty much everything else in the modern world. The opening lines set up this rant as he sings, "Sometimes I feel so low down and disgusted. Can't help but wonder what's happened to my companions. Are they lost or are they found?" America gets a roasting in the fourth verse with, "In the home of the brave, Jefferson's turning over in his grave. fools glorifying themselves trying to manipulate Satan. Her enemies also get a similar treatment in the previous verse as we hear all that foreign oil controlling American soil. Look around you, it's bound to make you feel embarrassed. By the end of the song, it's almost like Dylan is running out of targets as he places astrology in his crosshairs. He sings, I don't care about economy, I don't care about astronomy. Away from that, I love the repeated titular line of the song. As we've seen Dylan do many times before, he repeats the line at the end of the verse and it acts as a mini chorus. Here it's, there's a slow train coming up around the bend. I love the feeling this evokes. A slow train is something that cannot be stopped, something you can see coming towards you that's going to be here in the near future, but you have no control over it. Its moving nature also gives it an air of anxiety, especially when combined with the word slow. Bob's watching the world fall apart like he's been doing for most of his career, and he's documenting it here. This brilliant song is followed by something less brilliant. Gonna Change My Way of Thinking is a song that wouldn't have sounded out of place on the next decade's album Empire Burlesque, which, by the way, is not a compliment. The riff is straight out of the Big Guitar Riffs playbook, as is its cowbell. That feels like it was thrown in to just add something, anything, to the song. For the most part, the guitar, brass and bass and piano all play the same riff over and over again. Knopfler throws in some lead guitar work and Beckett tries to showboat on the organ, but this song cannot be saved.
Change my way of thinking. Make myself a different set of rules. Swords piercing your side. Blood and water flowing through the land. Well, don't know which one is worse. Doing your own thing or just being cool.
Even Bob's lyrics don't really get the blood pumping. He tells us constantly he's changing his way of thinking. He's found God. He's a better person now. Which should sound like a call to arms or a revelation, but it's so lifeless. It's a bit of a wet flannel. He sounds half interested. Despite the fact I'm not really a fan, the thing I do like about this song is it is unbelievably catchy. It's almost annoyingly catchy. The instrumentation is much more interesting on the next song, Do Right to Me Baby, brackets Do Unto Others.
Don't wanna judge nobody, don't wanna be judged. Don't wanna touch nobody, don't wanna be touched.
Here we have a much more atmospheric song being brought to the table. That electric piano from the opener is back, and we have a quickly picked acoustic guitar livening things up in the left ear. You'd assume this is from Knopfler. It sounds like him, and it also isn't a million miles away from the intricate picking of the Dire Straits classic Romeo and Juliet. However, unusually for the album, Knopfler is actually pretty subdued for the whole track. The lyrics take the idea of the Golden Rule and run with it. The Golden Rule is the principle of treating others as you would like to be treated. It's a maxim that is found in many religions and cultures, and here, as it is always, is closely associated with Christianity. The opening verse sets out the song's stall. Don't want to judge nobody, don't want to be judged. Don't want to touch nobody, don't want to be touched. Don't want to hurt nobody, don't want to be hurt. Don't want to treat nobody like they was dirt. We continue in this vein for the track's 4-minute runtime. It does get a little bizarre later in the tune as Dylan sings, don't want to wink at nobody, don't want to be winked at. Which, isolated, is verging on the ridiculous. What's Bob got against the winkers, or even the winkies? But I suspect that line only exists so it can rhyme with the next, which is, don't want to be used by nobody for a doormat.
Don't want to wink at nobody. I don't want to be winked at. Don't want to be used by nobody for a doormat. Don't want to confuse nobody. Don't want to be confused. Don't wanna amuse nobody. I don't wanna be amused.
The whole message of the entire record is summed up on the album's 7th song. Dylan announces he's woken up from a life of sin, and you should too. He challenges the listener, asking us, when you're gonna wake up? We finally get front and center the thing that has been lingering in the background for most of these religious songs, and that is anger. Bob appears to have found the right frame of mind to everlasting peace, but he's furious about it. If you're not on the train with him, then he's just annoyed. This feeling and anger gives us the impression that this new way of life for Dylan wasn't going to last forever. He doesn't seem completely settled with it. Whilst this track does have Bob throwing his entire hand into a preachy song, which is never a good idea, there's still some good lines here amongst all that preaching. I like the opener of, "God don't make promises he don't keep. You got some big dreams, baby, but in order to dream them, you've still got to be asleep." He's saying it doesn't matter how successful you are or how big your dreams are, unless you're under God, you're still unenlightened. I don't agree with the sentiments, but I do quite like the poetry. Once again, we're back on the world being full of sin and a terrible place. There's lines about crooked doctors and men who can't hold their peace. This is all encased in a song that continues the album's instrumentation. There's big organs and big hooks and, of course, big brass. This is a funny album, really. Some fans loathe it because it's part of Dylan's Born Again period. Some love it, with a good helping of those choosing to be antagonistic for the sake of it. Then there's some like me who don't really feel either way about it. There's some great songs on this LP. The less favourable compositions don't weigh it down. It's musically diverse, it's interesting, and it has some real highlights in it too, but I struggle to have much connection to it. If you're a Christian, this might be a standout Dylan record for you, as it means something to your ideals, but for me, it lacked any kind of intrigue or passion. In terms of sales, the album did well. It went to number 2 in the UK, and it went platinum in the US, coming in at number 3 on the Billboard chart, easily beating Street Legal's placing outside the top 10. However, Dylan wouldn't return there until 1997, meaning that for a while, this was the last blockbuster album we had from Bob. What would follow is a difficult and interesting period. But how did we end up here, and just why did Bob find himself delivering Christian albums? That's something we look at next time. When you're gonna wake up. Thank you for listening to this episode. As usual, if you want to discuss it, we are on Instagram and Twitter at Bob Dylan Podcast. Also, if you've been enjoying the show recently and you haven't rated us or reviewed us yet, then please do that. It really does help out. And of course, you can buy us a coffee too, a little kind of tip system. There is a link to do that in the description of this episode. Next, we are not really looking at an album. As you just heard, we're going to look at the context surrounding why Bob started to record Christian music. It's kind of like a special episode in fitting with this Christian period. So join us next time for that. In the meantime, thanks once again for listening, and goodbye. A Fueled by Coffee production.